Good morning, Columbia and Greene County. You are tuned to 90.7 FM WGXC. Acra Catskill, broadcasting live from Hudson. My name is Tyson. Welcome to Zoom. Pyramid Power. Check it out. It's groovy. It's one of those shows that I really dig, and I find out when I meet the programmer, I feel like I have kindred spirit, and they're like, I don't know who you are. So check it out. It's groovy. Zoom is a sound gate separating us from where we are and where we'll be. So it's Art's birthday. We're celebrating Art's birthday on Transmission Arts last night, WGXC, midnight till 6 a.m. And I am going to try to stay in that vein. And we have a pledge drive coming up early February, I believe. We are only as strong as the support that we get. So this is your station, guys. Stay plugged in, stay supportive, and just enjoy it. Monday Musical Matinee coming up next. Happy Martin Luther King Jr. Day. I don't know if it's appropriate to say happy, but I'd like to see things get a little better in America with all of us peoples in the world. It's a crazy time. I think community radio allows us as citizens and folks of the world to connect ourselves and express our differences and embrace our differences, because we are all just one human being, people from different tribes. Let's gather the tribes together and celebrate instead of fight. So that's all I got. Stay tuned for the next hour. I'm going to stay with the time travel theme, which I've been working on for the last couple weeks. I'm going to read the second chapter from a Michael Moorcock short story about a young fellow that travels back to the time of Christ and finds himself in a curious predicament. So stay tuned and stay supportive. 90.7 WGXC, your station. Talk to you in about 50 minutes. Let's travel.
and Booth will so that tell the error was before. But at the level of particles, there's in the equation no second law.
Right. So that led to the particles that move backward in time. Do particles like that really exist? I thought if anything actually went into the past, we'd end up with all sorts of strange paradoxes.
There is a particle called the past. It does exist. So first thing to do is not try to build some chamber and send it backwards in time, but just sending it. Just sending the message can create a paradox. Tell your grandfather to do something that makes it impossible for his grandmother first. But in this, the timescape, in a sense, splits in two. And you get two outcomes. One in which the grandfather never made you and you didn't exist and therefore the message didn't come back. The other one in which the grandfather didn't make the message. Something failed. And, or there may be other choices. You don't know that you're only supposed to two, three, four, five. Add in five. The whole idea behind the book is people were doing experiments to see if tachyons could be detected. If they were detected, then here came this immense problem. And in the sense, I was working out in the novel the physics that would be necessary to explain this problem if tachyons were found. So far, they haven't. Not reliably, though some experiments have turned up some evidence that they might be there.
Well, I'll keep my eyes open. Thanks, Greg.
Wanted to write a story that had some modern physics in it. It seems that most of science fiction often kind of stops after Kepler and Galileo and Newton, and they understand the laws of rocket mechanics and orbits, but don't go much further. That even the science fiction that deals with quantum mechanics really stops with the quantum mechanics of the 1920s, with Schrodinger and with Heisenberg. And doesn't go on to the very fascinating quantum mechanics that Dirac developed in the quantum field theories.
Yeah, the only other story I recall that used Dirac's work was James Blish's 1954 story, Beep, about a faster-than-light communicator. You obviously did a lot of research into Dirac. How did he come up with his unusual theories?
He came up with an equation, and then he said, well, what does this equation mean? It seems to be right, but what does it mean? And the only way that he could make it mean something in the real world was to postulate that all around us we are surrounded by an infinitely dense sea of negative energy particles. Everywhere inside of you, inside the Earth, all around us, in empty space, in space that's packed with matter, everywhere there's this infinitely dense sea of negative matter. And another interesting thing that was pointed out was these negative energy states. In quantum mechanics, negative energy formally corresponds to states that move backwards in time.
Okay, it might be possible, it might not, time will tell. But what draws SF writers to time travel isn't its scientific possibility, it's the amazing narrative potential. Writers who've done time and again include Terry Turtledove, Philip K. Dick, and Robert Silverberg, whose latest is a collaboration updating Isaac Asimov's classic The Ugly Little Boy, in which a Neanderthal child is plucked from the past for scientific study. Bob and Commander Rick, how did you and Isaac explain the fact that time travel didn't create huge paradoxes in The Ugly Little Boy?
We lied. Time travel really is fantasy. Unless you subscribe to the tachyon theory of small particles moving backward in time. I suppose you have a mathematical substructure that makes sense. But the rest of it is a convention that we apply to the audience.
So you don't feel any need to provide those sort of scientific explanations like Greg Benford
is trying to? I think we need to distinguish between scientific explanation and science. Greg is a physicist and has the vocabulary of science greatly at his command. I'm a science fiction writer who has picked up much of this vocabulary. It's not my native language, as it is my word. He knows, as I know, that it's all nonsense, that we are working with our languages. He found better wallpaper to put on the rest of us and do to disguise the cracks in the walls. But in fact, time travel is a very chancy concept. When I wrote a book called Up the Line, which I think is my fundamental statement on the issue of time travel, I tried to explore, in a comic but serious-minded way, all the paradoxes of time travel. If everybody goes back to see the crucifixion, the hill on which Jesus and the two thieves was crucified will be covered with millions of birds. This is a paradox that needs to be addressed. I addressed it. I addressed it thumb to the nose in some ways. But I tried to play with all of this. This is part of the fun of science fiction, an intellectual game. Once we begin to delude ourselves into thinking that we are literally projecting the future, we're fit to be taken away.
Right. Do you have a favorite time travel story, something maybe you wish that you'd written?
Well, I think the favorite has to be H.G. Wells' Time Machine, which is one of the two or three stories that led me into science fiction in the first place. The vision of the far future, I don't mean the Eloi and the Morlocks particularly, all that was wonderful stuff. I mean the journey that time travel takes to the end of time. I keep talking about the red sun and the crab crawling on the beach. I was 10 years old when I encountered that, and I thought, I will never live to see these things. He will. But he has shown them to me anyway. And that has stayed with me over the last 45 years or more as the great time travel story. But also there's Robert Heinlein's Finding Bootstraps. Very different in its effect because it doesn't attempt particularly to conjure up the wonders of the distant and unimaginable future, but simply sends the same character on a series of time loops. And this showed me that the intellectual side of the time travel is very right. If I had to pick one that I wish I had written, I think it would be about his bootstraps. The one that I would regard as my favorite would be the time machine.
Great choices. Thanks, Bob. By His Bootstraps is also one of Spider Robinson's two favorite time travel stories, according to his tribute to Heinlein entitled Raw, Raw, Raw.
He meets a time traveler who picks him up, puts him in a time machine, brings him back, and allows him to impregnate himself. Then they jump ahead 9 months in the time machine and take the baby girl that results in bringing that back to the time machine to grow up to become the girl who is impregnated by herself so that she can give birth to herself. And the man with the time machine has done all this in order to recruit our hero into the time police so that one day he can become the one who will make it possible for him to impregnate himself and therefore be born. There's a complete closed loop in time, a story in which if any of the events in it had not taken place, none of the events would exist. It ends with the protagonist, the agent of the time police, now a grizzled old veteran who's just finished making it possible for himself to exist. He goes back to the barracks and he lays down in his bunk and he looks down at the Caesarian scar on his belly and says, I know who I am, but who are all you zombies out there? That's elegant, that's beautiful, that's perfect, and as so often in perfect science fiction metaphors applies right at that little face.
Computer. December 21st, 2012, and through the worldwide VRML pickup of the internet, everybody with an IQ above 10 has gathered in the great collective space to witness the first attempt to send a human being through time. And at the World Temporal Studies Institute at La Chorrera in the Amazon, the president of so-and-so makes a speech. The lady time traveler makes a speech. She straps on her helmet. She steps into the machine. The fanfare for the common man is played. A button is pushed. And off she goes into the future. Now, what has always been put against time travel is what's called the grandfather paradox. And this is easy to understand. It goes like this. If time travel were possible, I could travel back in time and kill my grandfather. If I did that, I wouldn't exist, so I couldn't do it. Therefore, there's a closed loop of paradox. Therefore, time travel is impossible. I put this to the mushroom, and it said, well, time travel is possible, but you can only travel backwards in time as far as the moment of the invention of the first time. You can't travel further back in time than that, because there were no time machines before that. So it's a kind of barrier. Well, so then I thought, So then here was my model of what would happen when the Lady Temponaut sails off into the future. Let's forget about her and ask the question, what happens next in our world? And my first guess was, what happens next is thousands and thousands of time machines arrive from all points in the future. They have come back through time to witness the first time machine take off. It's as though you had a Piper Cub that you could fly to Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, to that windy morning in late December when the brothers Wright rolled it out of their bicycle shop and fired her up. And then I said, well, but wait a minute, we haven't dealt with the grandfather paradox. One of these time machines from the distant future, on its way to the first time flight, could stop off and kill the grandfather of the driver of that time machine, and we haven't gotten anywhere at all. So then I produced a slightly more complicated model, but at the work. So here's what it is. It's that because the future is not what we think it is, here's a metaphor which makes it more clear. In this world that we're living in right now, we have people such as Bill Gates and his research and development team, and we have people such as the upriver people in London that I spent time with, bare-ass people living at a very minimal cultural level. Gates and his people and this Amazon tribe occupy the same planet and the same moment in history. But who is influencing who? Very few people in the world are taking up the Amazonian lifestyle or point of view. Millions and millions of people are going Gates' direction, and more will. So what I concluded from that is that advanced states of culture tend to squeeze out or mitigate less advanced states of culture. Now let's return to the time flight. What happens when the Lady at Temponaut goes into the future is not that time machines arrive from all over the future. What happens is that the entire rest of the history of the universe happens instantly. In other words, a future evolutionary developments, conquest of the galaxy, vast technologies that allow star flight and wormhole travel and all that, the fruits of all that are delivered instantly to our doorstep in 2012. I call it the God Whistle model. In other words, we end the whole thing. We collapse the state vector and everything goes into a state of novelty. And it's and what happens then, I think, is the universe becomes entirely made of light.
stay in unison.
Behold the Man, Chapter 2. A story of youthful time travel. We Protestants must sooner or later face this question. Are we to understand the imitation of Christ in the sense that we should copy his life, and, if I may use the expression, ape his stigmata? Or in the deeper sense that we are to live our own proper lives as truly as he lived his and all its implications? It is no easy matter to live a life that is modeled on Christ's, but it is unspeakably harder to live one's own life as truly as Christ lived his. Anyone who did this would be misjudged, derided, tortured, and crucified. A neurosis is a dissociation of personality. Carl Jung, Modern Man in Search of a Soul. For a month, John the Baptist was away, and Glaugauer lived with the Essenes, finding it surprisingly easy, as his ribs mended, to join in their daily life and chores. The Essenes' township consisted of a mixture of single-story houses built of limestone, clay, brick, and the caves that were to be found on both sides of the shallow valley. The Essenes shared their goods in common, and this particular sect had wives, though many Essenes led completely monastic lives. The Essenes were also pacifists, refusing to own or to make weapons, yet this sect plainly tolerated the warlike John the Baptist. Perhaps their hatred of the Romans overcame their principles. Perhaps they were not sure of John's entire intentions. Whatever the reason for their toleration, there was little doubt that John the Baptist was virtually their leader. The life of the Essenes daily consisted of ritual bathing 3 times a day, prayer, and work. The work was not difficult. Sometimes Glaugauer pointed a plow pulled by 2 other members of the sect. Sometimes he looked after the goats that were allowed to graze on the hillsides. It was a peaceful, ordered life, and even the unhealthy aspects were so much a matter of routine that he hardly noticed them for anything other than routine after a while. Tending the goats, he would lie on a hilltop looking out over the wilderness, which was not a desert, but rocky scrubland sufficient to feed animals like goats or sheep. The scrubland was broken by low-lying bushes and a few small trees growing along the banks of the river that doubtless ran into the Dead Sea. It was uneven ground. In outline, it had the appearance of a stormy lake, frozen and turned yellow and brown. Beyond the Dead Sea lay Jerusalem. Obviously, Christ had not entered the city for the last time as of yet. John the Baptist would have to die before that happened, according to Scripture. The Essene's way of life was comfortable enough for all its simplicity. They had given him a goatskin loincloth and a staff. Except for the fact that he was watched by day and night, he appeared to be accepted as a kind of lay member of the sect. Sometimes they questioned him casually about his chariot, the time machine they intended to soon bring in from the desert, and he told them that it had borne him from Egypt to Syria, and then to here. They accepted the miracle calmly, as he had suspected. They were used to miracles. The Essenes had seen stranger things than this time machine. They had seen men walk on water and angels descend to and from heaven. They had heard the voice of God and his archangels, as well as the tempting voice of Satan and his minions. They wrote all these things down in the vellum's scrolls. They were merely a record of the supernatural, as their other scrolls were records of their daily lives, and of the news that traveling members of their sect brought to them. They lived consistently and constantly in the presence of God and spoke to God and were answered by God when they had sufficiently mortified their flesh and starved themselves and chanted their prayers beneath the blazings of the hot sun of Judea. Karl Glaugauer grew his hair long and let his beard become unchecked. He mortified his flesh and starved himself and chanted his prayers beneath the sun, as they did. But he rarely heard God, and only once thought he saw an archangel with wings of fire. In spite of his willingness to experience the Essenes' hallucinations, Glaugauer was disappointed, but he was surprised that he felt so well considering all the self-inflicted hardships he had to undergo. And he also felt relaxed in the company of these men and women who were doubtlessly insane. Perhaps it was because their insanity was not so very different from his own that after a while he stopped wondering about it. John the Baptist returned one evening, striding over the hills, followed by 20 or so of his closest disciples. Glaugauer saw him as he prepared to drive the goats into their cave for the night, and he waited for John to get closer. The Baptist's face was grim, but his expression softened as he saw Glaugauer. He smiled and grasped him by the upper arm, in a Roman fashion. "Well, Emmanuel, you are our friend, as I thought you were, sent by Adonai to help us accomplish his will. You shall baptize me on the morrow, to show all the people that he is with us." Glaugauer was tired. He had eaten very little, but spent most of the day in the sun tending the goats. He yawned, finding it hard to reply. However, he was relieved. John had plainly been in Jerusalem trying to discover if the Romans had sent him as a spy. John now seemed reassured and trusted him. He was worried, however, by the Baptist's faith in his powers. "John," he began, "I'm no seer." The Baptist's face clouded for a moment, then he laughed all crippledly. "Say nothing. Eat with me tonight. I have wild honey and locusts." Glaugauer had not eaten his food yet, which was the staple of travelers who did not carry provisions but lived off the food they could find on their journeys. Some regarded it as a delicacy. He later tried it as he sat in John's house. There were only two rooms in the house. One was for eating, the other for sleeping. The honey and locusts were too sweet for his taste, but it was a welcome change from the barley and the goat meat. He sat cross-legged opposite the Baptist, who ate with relish. Night had fallen. From outside came low murmurs and the moans and cries of those at prayer. Glaugauer dipped another locust into a bowl of honey that rested between the two of them. "Do you plan to lead the people of Judea in revolt against the Romans?" he asked. The Baptist seemed disturbed by this direct question. It was the first time that Carl had put this question to the Baptist. "If it be Adonai's will," he said, not looking up as he leaned towards the bowl of honey. "The Romans know this? I know not, Emmanuel, but Herod the incestuous has doubtless told him I speak against their unrighteousness. Yet the Romans do not arrest you." "Pilate dare not, not since the petition was sent to the Emperor Tiberius." "Petition?" "Aye, the one that Herod and the Pharisees signed when Pilate was the procurator did place votive shields in the palace at Jerusalem and seek to violate the temple. Tiberius rebuked Pilate, and since then, though he still hates us, the procurator is more careful with his treatment of us. Tell me, John, do you know how long Tiberius has ruled in Rome?" He had not the chance to ask that question until now. "Some 14 years," the Baptist answered. "It was AD 28, something less than a year before the crucifixion would take place, and his time machine was smashed." Now, John the Baptist planned armed rebellion against the occupying Romans, but if Gospels were to be believed, he'd soon be decapitated by Herod. Certainly, no large-scale rebellion had taken place as of yet. Even those who claim that the entry of Jesus and his disciples into Jerusalem and the invasion of the temple were plainly the actions of armed rebels had found no records to suggest that John had led a similar revolt. Glaugauer had come to like the Baptist very much. The man was plainly a hardened revolutionary who had been planning a revolt against the Romans for years and had slowly been building up enough followers to make an attempt successful. He reminded Karl Glaugauer strongly of the resistance leaders of the Second World War. He had a similar toughness and understanding of the realities of his position. He knew that he would only have one chance to smash the cohorts garrisoned in the country. If the revolt became protracted, Rome would have ample time to send more troops to Jerusalem. "When do you think Adonai intends to destroy the unrighteous through your agency?" Glaugauer asked tactfully. John glanced at him with some amusement. He smiled. "The Passover is a time when the people are restless and resent the strangers the most," he said. "When is the next Passover?" "Not for many months." "How can I help you? You are a Magus." "I can work no miracles." John wiped the honey from his beard. "I cannot believe that, Emmanuel. The manner of your coming was miraculous in itself. You see, the Essenes did not know if you were a devil or a messenger from Adonai." "I am neither." "Why do you confuse me, Emmanuel? I know that you are Adonai's messenger. You are the sign of the Essenes. You are the sign that the Essenes had sought for age untold. The time is almost ready. The kingdom of heaven shall soon be established on earth. Come with me. Tell the people that you speak with Adonai's voice. Work mighty miracles. Your power is waning. Is that it?" Glaugauer looked sharply at John the Baptist. "You need me to renew your rebels' hopes? You speak like a Roman, with a lack of subtlety." John got up angrily. Evidently, like the Essenes, he lived with and preferred less direct conversation. There was a practical reason for this, Glaugauer realized, in that John the Baptist and his men feared betrayal at all times. Even the Essenes' records were partially written in cipher, with one innocent-seeming word or phrase meaning something else entirely. "I am sorry, John the Baptist, but tell me if I am right," he spoke softly. "Are you not a Magus, coming in that chariot from nowhere?" The Baptist waved his hands and shrugged his shoulders. "My men saw you. They saw the shining thing take shape in the air, crack, and let you enter out of it. Is that not magical? The clothing you wore, was that earthly raiment? The talismans within the chariot, did they not speak of powerful magic? The prophet said that a Magus would come from Egypt and be called Emmanuel. So it is written in the book of Micah. Are none of these things true? Most of them. But there are explanations, he broke off, unable to think of the nearest word to rational. I am an ordinary man like you. I have no power to work miracles. I am just a man. Carl, John glowered. You mean you refuse to help us? I am grateful to you and the Essenes. You saved my life, most certainly. If I can repay that... John nodded his head deliberately. You can repay it, Emmanuel. How? Be the great Magus that I need. Let me present you to all those who became impatient and would turn away from Adonai's will. Let me tell them the manner of your coming to us. Then you can say that all is Adonai's will and that they must prepare to accomplish it. John stared at him intensely. Will you do this for us, Emmanuel? For your sake, John. And in turn, will you send men to bring my chariot here as soon as possible? I wish to see it be mended. I will. The Baptist answered. Glaugauer felt exhilarated. He began to laugh. The Baptist looked at him with slight bewilderment. Then he began to join in laughing. Glaugauer laughed on. History would not mention it, but he, with John the Baptist, would prepare the way for Christ. Christ was not born yet. Perhaps Glaugauer knew it 1 year before the crucifixion. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. John bare witness of him, and cried, saying, This was he of whom I spake. He that cometh after me is preferred before me, for he was before me. End chapter 2. Behold the Man, Michael Moorcock. Thank you for joining me for the House of Zoom this seasonably chilly Monday morning. I implore you, go out and make something out of nothing. Celebrate art's birthday. Monday musical matinee coming up at a hair after noon, after the news, at high noon. So stay tuned, and we have a pledge drive coming up in February, early February. I believe the 11th. I could be wrong. I'm going to find out. I'm going to let you know exactly what's going on. And I think you all know the importance of the pledge drives. It's our sustaining lifeblood. And we're only as strong as you guys. Get involved with us, WGXC.org. Come on down. Introduce yourself. Meet whoever's here. Community. Radio. The future. Taking back what's rightfully ours. Okay, so thanks for joining me for this hour. Be back again next Monday. Stay tuned today and every day to your hands-on, community-supported radio, WGXC, Acre, Catskill, and Hudson. Thank you for your kind attention. Goodbye.
Forever.